From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been 1 month since the Medicare prescription drug benefit went into effect. Tonight, in his State of the Union address, President Bush is expected to call for further changes in how Americans pay for health care. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss new and proposed changes with Jonathan Oberlander, the author of The Political Life of Medicare. Then we'll hear from Dr. Christine Castle, who's a specialist in geriatric medicine and the author of the new book, Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been a month since the new Medicare prescription drug plan went into effect. Tonight, in his State of the Union address, President Bush is expected to call for further changes in how Americans pay for health care. My guest, Jonathan Oberlander, is the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The president is advocating private medical accounts. Would you describe what that means?
The idea is that people will buy high-deductible health insurance, high-deductible meaning at least $2,000, and then you can put money aside in a tax-sheltered health savings account, and you would use that money to pay your routine medical expenses.
What are considered to be some of the benefits and some of the shortcomings of this approach?
Some of the benefits of it include the fact that it's portable, meaning now when you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. With a health savings account, you can take that money and you can move it with you to your next job, or if you don't have a job, you can still access it. Another benefit would be that, according to Lisa, folks who are in favor of this, people feel the cost of medical care more directly. They say they have more skin in the game. In other words, right now, if you're covered by comprehensive health insurance, you don't have a lot of incentive to shop around for the lowest cost care.
And what are some of the problems?
Well, I think there are some very serious problems with this. One is it's a very regressive way to finance medical care. Because what you're doing is you're really shifting the burden to those who use medical care the most. So people who have chronic illnesses, who are really sick, they're going to be paying out of those high deductibles year after year after year, and they're not going to build up very much money, if any money at all, in the health savings account. Another disadvantage of this is I really don't think it's going to control costs very well. 10% of Americans account for 70% of spending on medical care. And, you know, their medical care utilization is not going to be influenced by the introduction of co-payments and these deductibles, so it's probably not going to do a lot. A final thing that I think is important is it could have a potentially very damaging effect on the risk pool. One of the problems with American medical care is it's very, very fragmented already. And what you're doing with health savings accounts is you've created a form of insurance that is beneficial for people who are healthy. If those Americans pull out of the regular insurance market and join health savings accounts, the rest of Americans are going to be in insurance plans that become increasingly expensive.
The president in his State of the Union address is expected to also speak in support of tax deductions for out-of-pocket medical expenses. What does that mean?
Right now, there is a tax advantage to getting health insurance through your employer. And a lot of people have pointed out that it's really unfair for those that can't get health insurance through their employer that they can't enjoy the same tax deduction. So what they're proposing is to make this more generalizable and sort of level the playing field. I think it's an interesting proposal. The problem with it is it's really not going to do much for the uninsured, and it's not going to do much for healthcare spending.
Does this benefit people who are in high tax brackets more than it benefits people who are in lower tax brackets?
Yes. And in general, health savings accounts, back to what we were discussing earlier, are a much better deal for the healthy and the wealthy and represent another form of a sort of tax shelter. Because they're in higher tax brackets, they can put money away in their health savings account that is tax sheltered. And so they benefit more than folks at the lower end of the income distribution. They're also going to be in more of a financial position to do that.
Let's talk about the new prescription drug benefit. You've written a book on the politics of Medicare. How would you describe how the prescription drug benefit is doing so far?
Not well. It's been a confusing start. There's been a lot of chaos, a lot of serious problems, and frankly, enrollment is not very good so far.
I'm interested in what you've learned about what happened behind the scenes in the drafting of this prescription drug benefit. There have been a lot of questions raised about the role that lobbyists played and how that affected the final writing of the bill. Would you summarize what we know so far about that?
Well, I think the big picture to keep in mind is that this bill was written in large part for the prescription drug industry in the United States. the pharmaceutical industry for many years has opposed a Medicare drug benefit because they were worried that once the government got involved, they would start setting prices. And so the terms on which this legislation was finally enacted were meant to be very friendly to the drug industry in order to get their cooperation with the program. Now, in terms of the actual drafting of the bill, there was a question, serious question of conflict of interest. You had the former head of the agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid, Tom Scully, who right after the legislation was finished, left the government in order to become a healthcare lobbyist. You had another member of Congress who was on a committee that oversaw the writing of the legislation, who went to become the head of Pharma, which is the trade group for the prescription drug industry. So there's no question that lobbyists were involved in this. And again, the big picture is that this bill was written on terms purposely that are very friendly to the drug industry.
What is friendly about the terms of the prescription drug benefit part of the plan?
The two most important aspects of this legislation that make it a good deal for the industry, at least in the short run, is number one, the way this benefit works, you have to get it from private insurer. You have to get it not from the government. The government subsidizes you, but you've got to pick a private plan. And that's very different from the way the rest of Medicare works. The rest of Medicare is directly operated by the federal government. The second element of the bill that is really friendly to the industry is the bill prohibits Medicare from negotiating drug prices. And this is something that, of course, states do in the Medicaid program, the Veterans Administration does. Medicare would have tremendous power, tremendous market power. There are 42 million Medicare beneficiaries that would be purchasing drugs on behalf of. And that marketing power is precisely why the government was prohibited from directly negotiating prices.
Do you think that the new Medicare prescription benefit represents a change of philosophy in how Medicare is administered?
Absolutely. When Medicare was enacted in 1965, it reflected the politics of the time. You know, I always call it a programmatic flower child. It was a very liberal program that was based on a philosophy of universalism, of social insurance, a philosophy where the federal government was really responsible for the benefit. And, you know, sometimes we talk about single-payer health insurance in the United States, and Medicare really is a single-payer program where the government is the one responsible for the insurance. What we have seen in Medicare politics over time is the rise of a market model that believes instead of government running insurance, the market should run insurance. And government's role is simply to subsidize beneficiaries to go out in the private insurance market and choose their own plans. And this is really a fundamental shift in Medicare.
Who's advocating that? Why do the advocates want that?
Generally, conservatives and Republicans support that vision of the Medicare program. They argue that, you know, the federal government shouldn't be setting prices. It shouldn't be making choices on behalf of beneficiaries who have a better idea of what they want. They think it's a more efficient and a cheaper way to provide health care to the elderly and disabled in Medicare. Also in favor of having Medicare go in that direction is, of course, the insurance industry, because there are 42 million beneficiaries in Medicare right now. By 2030, that's nearly going to double to 77 million. That's a huge market and a potentially very profitable market. And if you move Medicare in a private direction, they stand to make a lot of money from that decision.
One of the problems with Medicare is that as the baby boom begins to retire, it's going to pose a really overwhelming expense, far different from the expense when Medicare was created in the mid-60s. So would privatizing the program and bringing, you know, private insurance companies into it solve the problem of the medical expense posed to the federal budget by the retirement of the baby boom?
No. You know, there's no doubt that there's an immense challenge ahead of Medicare. In many ways, the financing crisis, so-called crisis in Social Security, is really a modest problem. Medicare's financial problems are much greater in scope, much greater in complexity. At best, those reforms would save a very modest amount of money. I'm skeptical that they would do even that. There's no way to fund Medicare into the future and double its population without putting more money into the program, and that means higher taxes. There's just no way to do it. On the other hand, we need to recognize that Medicare's financial problems are not really of Medicare's own makings. What this reflects is broader problems in the American healthcare system. We have a very, very expensive healthcare system. 16% of the American economy goes to healthcare, which is much more than any other industrialized democracy in the world. If we don't take care of healthcare spending in the rest of the healthcare system, there is no way we're going to be able to control costs in the Medicare program.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, author of The Political Life of Medicare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Oberlander, the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There's the question of choice. The prescription drug benefit offers a lot of choices to people who are eligible. What do you feel are the lessons so far in the role of choice in a healthcare program for the elderly?
This program is really a test of consumer-driven healthcare, which is something that the president wants to pursue more broadly. And the idea of consumer-driven healthcare is we need to make medical care more like every other product that consumers go out and they shop for, and they look carefully at the benefits and the costs, and they select, just like they would a computer, the health insurance plan they want the most. And I think the lesson, we're early on here, but the lesson so far is you can have too much choice and it can be too confusing. You know, this program is an economist's dream to have all these Medicare beneficiaries making these decisions, making these choices, but in many respects, it's a patient's nightmare. In where I am in North Carolina, there are 53 different plans that beneficiaries can choose from, and it's a very, very complicated choice that requires not just a lot of patience, but a lot of computer skills. And I think what you have is a theory in search of a population, that theory being consumer-driven healthcare, and they found the wrong population. And so far, only 3.5 million Medicare beneficiaries have signed up voluntarily for this program, which really augurs for big trouble down the road. And that is in large part because they are paralyzed by too much choice.
The Medicare prescription benefit program is brand new. The problems haven't been ironed out yet. But what provisions are there for ironing out the problems? Do you expect that there will be some kind of major or minor reform as we see how the program's actually shaking out?
Some of the problems that are going on right now are simply because this is a new program, and there have been computer glitches, miscommunication between the federal government and insurers, problems with pharmacies. And I think a lot of those problems are going to be ironed out over time as people gain more experience with this benefit. But I think this is not just a matter of bad planning. What you have here is a bad theory, and it's going to be very hard to make this work smoothly, this vision of consumer-driven healthcare for the elderly and for the disabled. In terms of whether this benefit is going to be changed or whether we can expect reform, I'm not so sure. You know, a lot of people say to me, wow, the federal government's going to have to step in. This is such a mess. This has to change. But the original Medicare program had a lot of holes in it, and it's been 40 years, and it really hasn't changed very much. And a lot of people have a lot invested to make this work. It would be very expensive to change some of the provisions. So I'm actually not that optimistic that at least in the short term, we're going to see much change. What I do know is this. This is a very unstable program in an unstable market. And it's likely that a lot of the plans, private plans that are offering insurance coverage are going to leave that market. So it may look very different 5 years from now.
You think there might be fewer programs and therefore fewer choices in a less confusing environment?
Absolutely. And the plus side of that is it'll make the choice easier. The downside is there won't be as much competition on the basis of price, and so the premiums for the plans might get more expensive over time.
There are a lot of people who are on Medicaid who were automatically switched to the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. Would you explain that automatic switch?
Yeah, this is a population that we call the dual eligible population. So in other words, seniors and Americans with disabilities who have Medicare, but they're poor enough that they also have qualified for Medicaid. And historically, Medicaid has paid their prescription drug costs, so they already had drug coverage. What has happened as a result of this bill is that entire population, about 6 million, is being switched over to the Medicare program. And so they were supposed to be automatically enrolled in private insurance plans. And in fact, they were randomly assigned, which it turns out to be a big problem, to various plans across the states. And one of the central problems that we've seen in the Medicare drug bill so far is that assignment process has not gone very well. You have these low-income dual eligibles who are often very, very sick and include folks with developmental disabilities, mental illness, and so forth, showing up at pharmacies, and their coverage isn't working the way it's supposed to. They're being told they have to pay the $250 deductible and very high copays, none of which they're supposed to pay and none of which they can afford. And there have reportedly been cases of people who had to be rehospitalized because of lapses in their medication and so forth. Of all the problems with the Medicare bill so far, I would say this is the worst.
Is anything being done to address this problem?
To their credit, a number of states have stepped up to the plate. I think about half the states now are stepping in and paying medication costs for this population that has been lost in the shuffle, including California and Maine. And it's really to the credit of the states that they're doing this. You know, they are coming to the federal government's rescue, and the Medicare program is the federal government's responsibility. And to think that in 2006, you have to have Maine and California and a bunch of other states declare emergencies and step in to make this program work, it just never should have happened.
Since each state has its own insurance programs in this new Medicare prescription drug benefit system, what happens if you move? You know, a lot of older people reach the point in their health care where they're no longer independent, and they move to another state to be closer to children or grandchildren. So if you are elderly and you do move to another state and that state doesn't have the prescription plan that you've purchased, what happens?
There's a special provision that if you move, you're going to have a chance to re-enroll. And, you know, there's a certain number of plans, I can't remember the exact number, that are national in scope. But if you do move and say you get tired of those winters up in Pennsylvania and you want to come to Florida and have some sunshine, you'll have a chance to re-enroll.
But you have to go through the whole investigation process over again of, you know, being a good consumer and finding a new plan, doing all the research.
Yes. And, you know, I think there's a broader point here. I'm not sure this is how we want elderly Americans spending their retirement. But having gone through this whole mess, and right now people have until May 15th to pick a plan, come November 15th, they're going to have to do it all over again for next year. And it's likely that there are a number of people who are going to have to switch plans because those plans aren't going to be in business anymore.
So you're saying that every year there's an open enrollment, a period in which you can re-up in the plan that you're on or start the investigation process over again and choose a new one?
That's right. The fun has just started.
One of the ways people are being advised to choose a prescription drug benefit plan is to figure out what medications you need and to find a plan that reimburses well for those medications. But what about if you develop a condition that you didn't have when you chose the prescription drug plan? What if your needs change after you choose?
This is one of the many reasons why shopping for health insurance is not like shopping for a computer or a car. Your needs are going to change during the course of the year. And if all of a sudden you get a new illness that requires drugs, you're going to have to hope that it's covered by the formulary under the plan that you're on. And if it's not, then you're going to have to work really hard with your doctor to find an appropriate substitute, or you're going to have to wait until next year. The other really bizarre provision of this is plans can drop medications during the course of the year. As long as they give 60 days notice, they can actually change their formulary. So you sign up for a plan because they're covering a certain medication. A few months later, they may not be covering that medication anymore.
Are there any provisions in the Medicare bill to help older people decide on a plan. I mean, let's be honest, a lot of older people are having memory problems or vision problems, or they don't have a computer. And it's going to be very, it has been very difficult for many of them to figure out, you know, how the plan works and which insurance company to pick. Outside of asking children and grandchildren, is there any help provided for in the bill itself?
One of the problems is the agency that runs Medicare, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is really understaffed, and they really don't have the finances, they don't have the personnel to provide what you need, which is one-on-one counseling to get this done. They have made provisions to fund state agencies and community groups to provide counseling. And a lot of those community groups and state agencies are the best source of information on this bill. And I think they're doing a fabulous job, but they're not enough. They're just not enough for 42 million people.
The prescription drug plan obviously has some problems. Do you agree that it's unrealistic to expect that the bill will be rewritten in a major way, that we can expect a major overhaul in the near future?
Yes. In the short term, too many people are invested in this bill politically. Too many people are invested in the program financially. Over the long term, though, I think it's a bit more unstable and hard to see where it's going to go.
Jonathan Oberlander, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Jonathan Oberlander is the author of The Political Life of Medicare. He's an associate professor of social medicine in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mary After All, a debut novel about one woman's struggle to find herself in Newark, New Jersey, by Bill Gordon. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dr. Christine Castle, author of the new book Medicare Matters: What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. She specializes in geriatric medicine and says there are aspects of Medicare that are incompatible with the needs of older patients. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Christine Castle, has written a new book about Medicare from her perspective as a doctor who has spent her career caring for Medicare patients. She's also dealt with Medicare as the daughter of elderly parents who have since passed away. Castle is a specialist in geriatric medicine and the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Her new book is called Medicare Matters: What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. I asked her first about reactions from older patients to the new Medicare prescription drug plan.
everyone is confused. Everyone wishes there weren't so many choices. It's interesting, you know, many of the advertisements that you hear about healthcare in general are about choice. And people have come to think that choice equals quality in healthcare. But in fact, there is such a thing as too many choices, particularly when they aren't that really relevant to what it is that you need.
What about from your perspective as a physician? How is the new plan functioning?
It worries me because I'm afraid that people who need it the most are going to have the most trouble getting it. That is to say, people of low income, people who are confused or don't have good cognitive function, people who have major mental health needs, for example. And those are the people for whom this model of choice doesn't really make any sense. So they'll get arbitrarily assigned to some plan. And as I'm sure you've heard, many of them are falling between the cracks. The computer glitches haven't quite worked, et cetera. The other thing that is likely to really be a problem for people with any serious chronic illness, and particularly the Medicare patients who I am familiar with who have multiple chronic illnesses, is the complexity of this donut hole arrangement, the fact that a certain amount is covered up to a certain amount, then you get to that $2,200 amount, and then you get no coverage, and then when you get to $5,000, you get more coverage. It's very confusing. It's going to operate like that year after year, the way it's currently designed. So there isn't a sort of a logical, stable approach that people can expect.
Do doctors have to do any more administrative work with this prescription plan?
Absolutely. The first thing doctors have to do is answer patients' questions. Now, we have a problem with that in our healthcare system anyway, because there are so few physicians, generally primary care physicians, who are willing and able to actually answer patients' questions and their families' questions. Most doctors are specialists, that you see them just for this problem or that problem, and they aren't equipped to answer your questions about the drug benefit. You know, another thing that is really a problem about this, I'm sure you have seen the stories in the press about people, baby boomers like ourselves, helping their parents get online, figure out which you know of the plans is best for them. And the way you do that is you put in all the medications you're currently on, and then it runs an analysis and tells you what's the best deal. Well, that assumes that those are going to be the drugs you're on for the rest of your life. And nothing could be a more unrealistic assumption in this day of rapidly evolving medical science. Plus, as we age, we know that things happen and your medical problems are likely to get more complex, not less so.
On the whole, I think you feel very grateful for Medicare, both as,
yes.
Somebody who was helping to take care of elderly parents and as a physician who specializes in geriatric medicine. But you see some problems with Medicare the way it exists now. And that's what your new book, Medicare Matters, addresses. So I'd like to talk about some of those issues that you address in the book. You say that the Medicare system is no longer compatible with how geriatric medicine is practiced. And one example that you give is the kind of medical teamwork that's especially needed in geriatric medicine. Would you explain why that teamwork is so important and how you think Medicare neglects to really deal with that?
An elderly patient, somebody who's 85 or 86 years old, who has 6 or 7 different chronic conditions, heart failure, hypertension, diabetes, arthritis, maybe mild dementia, osteoporosis that needs to be treated, that's not unusual. Any single doctor alone in an office or in an office with a nurse is never going to be able to adequately manage all of that patient's problems because they need interaction with themselves and, when necessary, with family members or other support systems in the community to manage unexpected events that happen. You don't want to be calling 911 every time you have a dizzy spell. And yet, most doctors' offices aren't really prepared to respond to a telephone call for something like that. How do I manage that? Patient education. You have 14, 15 different medications. They interact with each other. You're going to multiple different specialists. None of them know what the others are prescribing. And somebody, one person, has to manage the interaction of all those, make some decisions about what's better, what's not, hopefully reduce some of those medications or the complexity that they have. Finally, you treat the patient, not the disease. Now, that sounds like a cliche. We hear that all the time. But there are times when treating a specific disease can lose sight of what that person's function and functional goals are because there's, for example, side effects of a medication. Or the patient may decide not to pursue aggressive surgery, let's say for a knee replacement, if they have a lot of other problems and their quality of life balance is just a decision not to do that. That's where you really need geriatric medicine and is in coordinating that team. Plus, all the other specialists that are involved in the care of that patient.
So in what ways is that difficult to do under the current Medicare system?
Because Medicare doesn't pay for any of those activities that I just described to you. Medicare pays me as a physician when the patient comes to my office and for a visit, I see the patient. Medicare pays for laboratory tests, for x-rays. Medicare pays when the patient goes into the hospital. But if I have a patient, let's say with heart failure, who's getting worse, and I find that out, call the patient up, discover that there are some medication changes I could make to avoid the patient having to come into my office and potentially go in the hospital, I get paid nothing for that. So it's actually in my financial interest to order unnecessary tests or even tests that have been done by somebody else, rather than go to the time and effort of trying to track down the results of those tests from another specialist. There's no reason. It makes my office actually more efficient for me just to repeat these tests.
My guest is Dr. Christine Castle. Her new book is called Medicare Matters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Christine Castle, and she's the author of the book Medicare Matters. She is a physician specializing in geriatric medicine. She's also the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine. There are certain rules for rehab and nursing homes that I know you find frustrating as well, rules in terms of what and when Medicare will cover, will provide financial coverage for that. Give us an example of a frustration that you have with the coverage for rehabilitation.
The most frustrating thing for rehabilitation is that it only covers rehab services up to a patient's plateauing, and they have to keep getting better in order for Medicare to keep paying for it. Well, the patients that I see, people who might be very frail, need to have maintenance physical therapy in order to keep their muscle strength as they get frailer. And if they stop that therapy, they get worse. But that's not enough of a justification for payment to continue. You've got to be recovering. It's that same acute care model. If you've had a hip replacement or a broken hip or cardiac rehab after a heart attack or a cardiac surgery, then you need to have that rehab model. That's more of an acute care model. But in terms of maintenance, that isn't built into the system.
And what about when somebody's eligible to be in a nursing home or a rehab unit?
Well, this, I'm sure your listeners know, is not a straightforward business at all and is very variable all over the country. But it is fair enough to say that Medicare has never been committed to covering most long-term care expenses. And so it constrains what it covers just to things that are just post-hospital. And there's various ways of defining that, but whatever that few-month period is that you might need to get over an acute care hospitalization. Now, there could be a lot of efficiencies to our whole healthcare system if we had one system covering both acute and long-term care. But since we don't, it's very easy for the acute care system, the hospital, to say, okay, let's send this patient, it's time for the patient to go to the nursing home, and then somebody else has to pay for it, either the family or often the Medicaid program.
Another example of how Medicare pays or doesn't pay has to do with hospice. And there are certain rules. If you want Medicare reimbursement for a hospice, you have to agree to give up certain things. What are those things?
You have to agree not to use any kind of, quote, curative treatments. And that's a very complex thing, how that's defined. Not to call an ambulance if you feel sick, that you call the hospice team and they come to your home. And the reason for this is because the idea was that most of the people using hospice are people who are at the end of life, and they probably wouldn't need an ICU, for example. But they might very well need an emergency room visit if their hospice team isn't set up directly to care for everything that they need. A good hospice team could be, but sometimes, for example, someone who's suffering from advanced cancer may have a pneumonia, may have some kind of infection that you're not going to cure. It's not going to lengthen their life, but if you treat it, it will reduce their suffering, help their breathing, reduce pain, for example. It might need a hospitalization. And so, and intravenous drugs, for example, or other kinds of things that are considered more high tech. So that just tells you why it's so difficult for a government program to set arbitrary limits on what's covered and what's not. And why, if you have an interdisciplinary team with geriatric experts and palliative care experts, they could personalize that management for each patient.
So we have a dilemma here. You're saying that Medicare, which is extraordinarily expensive, doesn't really cover enough, and some of what it covers seems kind of arbitrary. So to solve the problems that you're saying would mean changing the system so that it's even more expensive, you know, at a time when the government is already in debt, there's a huge deficit, and everybody's trying to cut money wherever they can. So it seems very unlikely that Congress is about to change Medicare to expand what is reimbursable. So, you know, trying to look at it like realistically, what do you think some of the options are?
You're exactly right. We can't just keep saying more and more and more. And we particularly can't be saying more and more and more at today's prices. So what I'm calling for in the book is that all of us, as a group of citizens of the United States, begin to look at this program as something that is part of our social contract with the government. And that as we do that, we understand that it benefits not just the elderly, but it benefits families. As you and I know, if Medicare wasn't there for our parents and for our friends' parents, we would be paying for that medical care for those people. And already the burden often does fall of the organizing and the managing onto the families. So I see Medicare as a family benefit, not just a benefit for the elderly. Now, that said, it is also a huge market force because all of this fancy new technology, new drugs, et cetera, primarily is used in older people because that's when all of us start to face major illnesses and illnesses that can benefit from this. And we have a marketplace system of healthcare in this country. So we have lots of industries who are doing very well in the business of selling medical care. These include insurance companies, pharmaceutical industry, device manufacturers, many physician specialists, and medical groups. So we have a very brisk and effective marketplace in many aspects of medical care, but we pay more by far than any other country in the world for medical specialties, for drugs, for devices, and even for hospitalizations. So it seems to me that if we as a nation really believe that an effective Medicare system is essential for successful aging, for keeping our society productive as we're all getting older, that we have to figure out a way to rein in those costs.
You recommend a form of rationing in your book. And rationing always sounds really horrible, like you'll only be allotted so much, and then if you get sicker than that, you're out of luck. You've gotten your share already. So what is the kind of rationing that you think would work?
I think that we are already rationing healthcare. If you look at the donut hole in the Medicare drug benefit, that's a form of rationing. It's saying we're only going to pay for so much. Rationing doesn't say that you can't have the things that aren't covered. It just says you have to pay for them. So what I would prefer is to see a basic package of healthcare services or something like a monthly fee that could be a capitation fee that clinical groups could manage. And then if people wanted to buy something above and beyond that, they would be free to do so. So it doesn't have that dreaded idea of rationing that, quote, I can't get this. I think Medicare ought to have the right to negotiate prices with drug companies. As you know, in the legislation, that is explicitly forbidden. Every other nation in the world negotiates prices, lower prices than what we pay in this country, for those medications. So it's those kinds of things that I think if we agreed collectively that this is an important program, we could do.
You're very critical of the new Medicare prescription plan. You're critical of Medicare the way it is now because there are a lot of things that aren't covered that you think should be covered or should be covered differently than they are currently covered. At the same time, there's a lot you like about Medicare. What are some of the things that you actually like about the program?
I think it's very important that we keep the Medicare program as a government program in this country. And I worry that because people are focusing on its flaws, that they may think the answer is just to throw it all over to the private sector and private plans, which I think are not going to turn out to be as efficient. The things I like about it are, first of all, that it's universal. It covers everyone and covers everyone with similar and comparable benefits. So it makes it easy for patients to understand it and easy to administer. Leads to the second thing I like about it. It has very low administrative costs. Medicare costs, administrative costs are 3 to 5% compared to almost all of the private sector, which is between 15 and 25%. That's a lot of wasted money that goes to administrators rather than going to deliver health care. And the last thing that I think is really important about it is that it supports innovation and training in medical care. It actually supports young physicians getting good training.
With this new prescription drug benefit in effect for Medicare, where do you see Medicare heading in the future?
I worry about that, Terry. I worry because I think that a lot of people think that Medicare needs to be more like the private sector of healthcare and commercial insurance. And that's the model for the Medicare drug benefit. It's clearly the way that was established. And what that's done is to make it very inefficient, lead to all the confusion that we talked about earlier, and I don't think promises to solve the fundamental problems of Medicare. So what that says to me is that the market system has failed. And if we go too far down that road, we may not be able to put it back together again as a social insurance program. The most important thing about the universal coverage of Medicare is that you spread the risk across the whole population. And as soon as you start slicing and dicing that, you have insurance companies that take the healthier people, leaving the sicker ones behind, and pretty soon you can't afford any kind of insurance program for the very sick people. So it's essential that we somehow keep this as a universal program.
My guest is Dr. Christine Castle. Her new book is called Medicare Matters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Christine Castle, is a specialist in geriatric medicine. Her new book is called Medicare Matters. We've had to navigate through geriatric medicine, not just as a doctor who specializes in that field, but as a daughter who had elderly parents who have since passed away.
That's right.
What were some of the conditions and illnesses that your parents had to deal with in their later lives?
Well, my mother had serious arthritis and also dementia, and was determined to stay in her own home. And so we had to manage her ability to move around and the medications that she was on and multiple physicians that she saw. She developed breast cancer and needed to have a lumpectomy to have that removed, and then radiation treatment. And managing all of those through multiple different hospitals, we were very fortunate because there was a where she lived, there were a network of volunteers who would pitch in, drive her to the radiation treatment, help manage her care at home. And between my sister and myself, we spent a huge amount of time. My sister lived nearby, so she had the major burden of this. And I would fly in and out on weekends. So it was a big effort together to kind of manage that kind of care. But she did stay at home, and I think that was, you know, something that was very much better than having her had to go to a nursing home. In my father's case, he lived longer and was quite active and vigorous, and then developed a malignancy and was treated by chemotherapy for the malignancy. There was a situation where it was clear that he had to go into the hospital in order to get all of the drugs, including something as simple as an injection to help keep his blood counts up, when a visiting nurse could have just as easily come to his home and given it to him, but it wouldn't get reimbursed that way. It would only get reimbursed if he came into the hospital. So that was a good example of something that was very inconvenient for him, very inconvenient for us.
Because you had to help him get there.
Because we had to help him get there, right. And didn't really, to me as a physician, make a lot of sense.
What was the end of life for your father like?
He died in the hospital where he had been admitted because of complications from his chemotherapy. He was actively receiving chemotherapy at the time. And as it became clear over the course of the hospitalization that he was not going to get better, he made it very clear to all of us that he did not want aggressive treatment, that he was a believer in hospice and thought that this time had come, and he didn't want to be intubated. He didn't want to be on a respirator. So that was all very clear, and I think the nurses who took care of him were excellent. But the hospital didn't have a palliative care program. I asked at the time, I said, do you have a palliative care team who can come now and help manage his symptoms? Because he was very short of breath. This was a situation where the problem wasn't so much pain, but it was just that he struggled to breathe. And that's a very difficult symptom to manage. And they didn't. This was an otherwise very good hospital, but they didn't have anybody in palliative care. None of the interns and residents involved in his care who were otherwise very good knew what to do. So the only thing they could think of to do was to put him in the intensive care unit, because those were people who knew how to manage people who couldn't breathe. So in retrospect, I now have worked with a number of hospitals that have implemented palliative care teams in the hospital for this kind of situation. Because much as all of us might think that what we'd like is to be at home when we die, not in the hospital, it just doesn't always work out that way. And people do die in hospitals, and there's absolutely no reason why you can't deliver the same quality of palliative care that hospice gives you at home in the hospital.
It must have been so frustrating for you as a daughter and as a doctor specializing in geriatric medicine to know what could be done what could have been done to improve your father's situation, and yet to be helpless to do anything about it.
It was frustrating, and it really inspired me to continue to devote a lot of my efforts to helping to improve this situation.
Dr. Kessel, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Christine Kessel is the author of Medicare Matters. She's the president of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at BN. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, and the connections between them. We talk with two Washington Post reporters. Susan Schmidt broke the Abramoff story and continues to cover it. Jeffrey Smith is covering the DeLay money trail and the charges against him. Join us for the next Fresh Air.